We begin this hour with a critical look at the relationship between the public, its politicians, and the U.S. military. At the end of World War II, nearly 10% of the U.S. population was on active military duty. Nearly every American knew someone in war. It was part of our daily lives, our culture, our daily conversations with one another. Well, today, fewer than 1% of Americans are on active duty, and despite 13 years of war in Iraq and Afghanistan, this is usually the closest any of us ever come to thinking about the realities.
I want to tell all the troops over there in Afghanistan how much we appreciate what they're doing for our country to protect our freedom. We are praying for you, and Omaha.
That's Denver Broncos quarterback Peyton Manning before the 2014 Super Bowl. In sports stadiums, in political debates, and just about everywhere else, support the troops has become so common a slogan that our next guest says it's passed into damaging cliche. James Fallows has spent a lot of time thinking about this shift in our relationship with the military and how, slogans notwithstanding, we've fundamentally degraded the way we think about this institution we hold in such high regard. James Fallows is national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. He's written a comprehensive essay entitled The Tragedy of the American Military. James, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Todd, thanks very much.
It's very good to have you. You write in your piece about the chicken hawk nation as sort of the basis for a critique on the American culture's relationship with its military. What does that mean? What's the chicken hawk nation?
So the term chicken hawk is one that came into vogue, I guess, in the early Iraq war days, when you had people who themselves had not been part of the military but were eager for somebody else to go to war. That is the idea that you're happy to have a war as long as somebody else is going to do the fighting. In a way, I think that's come to exemplify the modern United States, where the vast majority of the country is not affected in any tangible way by the fact that we're perpetually at war. So we have fewer than 1% of the population who over the last dozen years have been more or less indefinitely extended in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. And I think this is unwholesome for the country, for the military, for the world, and for our politics.
Now, you say it makes it not only too easy to go to war because of this separation between American society and its fighting forces, but also a disincentive for accountability, that Americans just don't demand the kind of accountability from the military brass that they used to, and that sort of adulation, and if I dare say it, fetishism for the military has taken the place of real accountability.
One thing I should tell your listeners before talking about accountability is that when saying it's too easy to go to war, it doesn't matter that I personally think that. I think it matters more that Admiral Mike Mullen, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said that on the record to me. He thought the separation between the military and the public had made it simply too easy to go to war. And Admiral Mullen, that man in charge of waging our wars for quite a long time, said he thought that in the future he hoped more people would have to be inconvenienced if the United States decided that it wanted to go to war. On the accountability front, I think many of your listeners, probably most modern Americans, have grown up in the age where there was nothing like a draft. There was no sort of enforced connection between military commitments around the world and the way most people went through their daily lives. And so there's been a sort of increasing distance, which is very different from the way American society worked through most of the 20th century. I talk in the piece about how after World War II, which is, of course, a mass mobilization war, and then even through the Korean and Vietnam ages, people may have been critical of the military, but they were familiar enough of it to respect what was good about it, but also recognize that, like any other large institution, it had shortcomings and failings and blind spots, and you could make fun of it. Now the idea of making fun of the military or referring to its members as anything other than heroes has become almost anathema, and that you have what seems to me the really unwholesome pathology of these salute to the heroes rituals, which we have at halftime of games or when you get on, they get on airplanes early, substituting for any serious accountability of how the troops are being led, how our money is being spent, where people are going to be asked to fight and kill and die.
Do you think that this reverence, in some cases this enforced reverence or what I call fetishism for the military at certain times, is an intentional proxy for real accountability? Do you think this is by design, or do you think it's cultural inertia that has led to this?
That's a really interesting question, and I don't know. I mean, certainly if you trace back a generation plus, it was intentional on the part of Richard Nixon to end the draft because he knew that dissent over the draft was one of the main impediments to the Vietnam War that was causing riots all around the country. And so it was intentional to separate military action from public distress or discord in that way. And I quote in my article a man named John Nagel, a person I respect and like, saying that he thinks that's a good thing. It's good to have kind of a Praetorian guard who can go out and do the nation's business without disrupting most of the citizens. But I think for most of the public now, it's a subliminal or unconscious or whatever other term you'd want to use, displaced sense of if you can spend those 30 seconds of saluting the heroes at sporting events or clapping for them at airports, that somehow replaces viewing the military as a part of real life for the 99% of the public who are not members. You know, schools are part of our real lives. The medical system is part of our real lives. Pollution, roads, whatever else. For most people, the military is not really part of what we're engaged in day by day. And I think that's the way you set it up is a sort of displacement, I would agree with.
I've always wondered, James Fallows, if part of it isn't a collectivization of guilt from Vietnam as well. I mean, you talk about the accountability that came after Vietnam, which was both constructive, which was the military officer corps doing real reforms and real accountability on itself after the failures of Vietnam, but also a bad kind of accountability, which was the American public in many ways turning on the troops who were returning home, spitting on them. We've all heard of the images abusing soldiers who went to fight there after they came home. I wonder now if the reverence that is paid constantly at sporting events and everywhere else to the military without any real demand for the kind of accountability that you're talking about might come from sort of a collective guilt of the failures of Vietnam.
I think that is so. And I think there is a retrospective lesson that while within the military, as you point out, there was quite rigorous and excoriating examination of what had gone wrong with the officer corps and with tactics and with strategy and with ethics that led to all the agonies of Vietnam. I think as time goes on, the lesson from the public is that the public itself was wrong, as the public was, in turning on so many of the actual fighting soldiers and fighting Marines and naval personnel who had been out there doing the nation's work. And so as time goes on, that's at least one mistake people aren't going to make. And it may have been, I haven't yet traced exactly the time when it became unvarying. You would refer to anybody in uniform as a hero. But sometime after 9/11, that became the style, and it's almost dangerous not to do that now. People within the military know that theirs is a varied institution, as it has always been, with good people and bad people and the need for some kind of honest assessment. It does happen inside the military, but on the public basis. You know, after our previous wars, you had presidents removing generals and commanders for reasons of military incompetence. Probably the most famous case would be Abraham Lincoln and George McClellan, but Harry Truman had his fights with Douglas MacArthur and all the rest. Now, when senior officers are relieved of command, it's almost always for discipline problems of some sort. General David Petraeus with his affair, Stanley McChrystal with his leaks, et cetera. And it's as if we think we can't judge them anymore on how they are doing their job as leaders.
And at the same time, somebody listening to this might sneer at you, James Fallows, and at me, Todd Zwillick. You haven't served, and neither have I, nor will we.
No, and I very clearly pointed, every time I've written about the military in the last 45 years, I pointed out that during the Vietnam War, I was very much opposed to that war. I was protesting against it, and I took legal but intentional steps to stay out of the draft. So I think that this is what was a source of tension back in the Vietnam War era, where everybody was affected and you had to find ways to be involved or not, is now the norm.
Now, let's talk about our politicians for a moment, because they are the ones who hold the purse strings and set the policy. And you outline some major failures in that regard in your piece. It is extremely easy, in fact, common for members of Congress, among whom I spend much of my time, to lobby for increased military budgets. Even those who want to rein in the military in general only try to slow the growth, not cut the military. That's anathema. And fall over themselves to praise veterans all the time. And you think there's a major disconnect here.
There is. If you have the military not affecting most people in terms of, you know, only a tiny fraction of a congressperson's constituency will actually be in the service, the main way in which the military affects each district is through spending. And so you have people in the House and the Senate sort of falling over themselves to get projects for and subcontracts to their own district, even if they think that the projects are misinformed. There are two illustrations I mentioned in my piece. One is Bernie Sanders, who I actually like very much. I agree with many of his politics. He's a former socialist, now independent senator from Vermont. He thinks the F-35 fighter plane is a bad choice for America, but he's been pushing hard to get it based in Burlington, Vermont. Because if it's going to be someplace, it might as well be Burlington and keep up the high-tech jobs there. The other is a vote in the House committee that was deciding on defense budgets. This was before the recess last this fall, when the vote in the committee was 61-0 in favor of the military budget. This is the same House that can't agree on anything. But when it comes to military spending, there's basically there's no involvement in the details except for where the budget money goes district by district.
And it seems like there's not really much of a debate at all in Congress about the overall role of the military and the military budget. Now, we did have a debate over the last couple of years about the broad strokes of the American economy and federal budgeting. Military spending was part of that, and sequestration was one of the results. They didn't agree to much. But in the halls of Congress, there really isn't much debate about the size of the military, the amount of spending devoted to GDP. It's really one party that wants to increase things really, really drastically and another party that wants to increase them more slowly, in my estimation.
I would agree with that. And here are two ways to illustrate the difference. One is, when I was first reporting on these issues in the early 1980s, there were at least three prominent, rising, ambitious politicians who made their mark by talking about the details of military strategy and the big picture on how the U.S. should be involved. One was Gary Hart, who was, of course, then a young Democratic senator from Colorado, and two other were young Republican congressmen. They were Newt Gingrich and Dick Cheney. And the three of them actually agreed on more than they disagreed about the need to shift military strategy and weapons design and all that. It is almost impossible to find anybody like them in the Congress now, people who are really, really deeply informed and not in a partisan way on the way the United States should evolve its military strategy. Another illustration would be the 2012 debates between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama, where the only time that military issues came up in the debates was simply a contest of who was going to spend more. President Obama said that the military is strong. Mitt Romney said he would spend $1 trillion more. And Obama said that was more than the military wanted. And they had a little colloquy about whether it still needed cavalry horses and all the rest. But essentially, at the presidential level and the congressional level alike, the part of our political system that is designed to make big choices and to exert accountability just has atrophied away.
Do you think that we can maybe add Senator John McCain of Arizona, a veteran, of course, former prisoner of war, but also somebody intimately involved in military affairs, to the list of politicians who are at least well-informed about the military?
Certainly, Senator McCain is well-informed, well-experienced, and I think when he speaks about torture in particular, the lessons of his own life are they melt away much of the opposition. I have great regard for what he's done for relations with Vietnam over the years, what he's spoken about torture. He also in recent months has been involved in a dispute about the A-10 attack plane, which I talk about in my article. I think that in general, while he is well informed, he has slid into more sort of just the partisan debate. But I respect very much his stance on torture, stance with the A-10 and some other issues, too.
James Fallows, do you think there might be some hope in the fracturing of the Republican Party we've seen in recent years? And I say that thinking about the rise of Senator Rand Paul, who's going to run for president. He may or may not win. He may or may not get the nomination. But he represents a minority of the Republican Party that is vocally against military adventurism, vocally against some of what they think of as the stupidity of the last two wars and American intervention in conflicts overseas. Whether or not you agree with the political philosophy, is it potentially healthy to have that split in the Republican Party right now?
I think it has to be. And I think that when either party becomes monolithic on certain issues that historically have been sources both of ferment within parties and sometimes agreement between parties, it's a good sign when that monolith begins to crumble. And so I think that to the extent the Republican Party is becoming more hospitable to people who will be willing to question the cost and the rationale of America's overreach, in my view, over the last 15 years, I think that is good. So in general, America has done best over the last century plus of its era as an international power when people in both parties have tried to debate some of the fundamentals of what we should fight for, where we should stand, how we should fight, what the balance between ends and means is. And so if that is breaking out the Republican Party, that's good. And I hope more of it comes to the Democratic Party, too.
At the same time, we've seen a President Obama who, as a candidate, I think tried to draw some lines around a less adventuresome military doctrine. Of course, he was running in the aftermath of the Iraq War and the somewhat less unpopular Afghanistan War. But that's a president who, after he's taken over as commander-in-chief, has found himself dragged back into military conflict. That's the charitable view, or has executed escalations himself, both in the drone war and in the return to Iraq to fight ISIL. His tune has changed.
Yes, and I think that when historians look at the era that you and I are talking about right now, or if either of us is talking about this 10 years from now, I think we'll look at Obama as a very interesting and important transitional figure on just these grounds. He became president, I would argue, precisely because he had opposed the Iraq War before it began. That's the only thing that gave a then unknown senator any standing to run against Hillary Clinton. So he had some sort of an ability to draw distinctions in international commitments as part of his patrimony in coming into office. And I think he has tried in insisting on the drawdown from Iraq, in allowing a surge in Afghanistan, but then also refusing to continue it. He's tried to carry out that initial view he had. At the same time, as you say, he's extended the drone part of America's aggressive foreign policy more than it had been before. He has not been able to rein in the Guantanamo situation. The national security surveillance state is at least as advanced under him as it was before. So I think people will study this time as an era when the United States figured out what was malleable and what may not be in America's foreign position.
Well, you know, James Fallows, I'm a little worried, both for you and maybe a little bit for me, that some of the people who hear this discussion might simply respond by yelling at their radios, support the troops. You don't support the troops. And that makes me wonder where we go from here.
I will say that I've gotten a ton of response in the 24 hours since it's been out online. I've gotten hundreds and hundreds of letters, most of them from people either in the military or in military families, and most of those, an overwhelming majority, supportive, saying that they are the first ones to recognize the hollowness of saying, oh, yes, support the troops, now leave us alone. I mentioned in my article that, oh, yes, America loves the troops, but doesn't really want to think about them. One young Marine wrote to me this morning saying, whenever he hears support the troops, what he hears, the way it sounds to him, is get back to your foxhole. So I think the empty slogans about support your troops, they are no real substitute for engaging with our troops and knowing our military and taking the same kind of critical responsibility for it that we do with any other institution that matters in our republic.
Perhaps fewer bumper stickers, perhaps fewer slogans, and maybe more actual sit-downs, more engagement with members of our military. James Fallows of The Atlantic, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Todd.